Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the legal troubles facing both former Attorney General Barr and Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani, and speak with Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast, and a columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where he has an op-ed, Rudy Giuliani's Outrage is the Refuge of the Scoundrel. We will discuss the efforts by federal judge Amy Berman Jackson to force the Justice Department to release the memos that reveal the legal advice behind how Barr spun the Mueller report, which the judge noted the former Attorney General hardly had time to skim before misleading Congress and the American people that the report had exonerated Trump. We will also examine the Department of Justice's role in twice blocking search warrants of Giuliani's electronic devices, and the irony that had the second attempt at getting a search warrant after the election been approved, then Giuliani would have sought, and Trump would have approved, a blanket pardon, something that Rudy had asked for but Trump had refused because he was mad at his lawyer for charging $20,000 a day for his so-called legal services. Then we'll look into the genocide underway in Tigray in Ethiopia, which the world has been ignoring for the last 6 months, as the Ethiopian army, in concert with the Eritrean army, are slaughtering civilians and destroying their livelihoods in order to starve the Tigrayans to death. Dennis Wadley, the director of Bridges of Hope International, a community development organization working mostly in Africa, joins us to discuss how he recorded the head of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church's message that has now gotten out to the world, announcing that a genocide is going on in Tigray, not unlike what happened in Rwanda. Then finally, we'll examine the backlash to Biden's proposal to suspend vaccine patents, which European leaders at a EU conference in Portugal oppose, and at which French President Macron said that waiving patents should be fourth on the list of priorities and that the real problem is production, and quote, the Anglo-Saxons must first stop their export bans. An expert on intellectual property and copyright, Sham Balganesh, a professor of law at Columbia University, joins us to discuss the petition to the World Health Organization from South Africa and India and what can be done to reverse the rampant pandemic in India, since nobody on the planet is immune until everyone is immunized. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is Rudy Giuliani's Outrage is the Refuge of a Scoundrel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be here as always.
Well, thanks, Harry. And of course, one of the expressions of outrage coming from Rudy Giuliani in his press appearances on Fox after the feds announced that they were investigating him, and they'd apparently tried twice during the Trump era, he said something to the effect that, my God, they think I'm a Russian spy. Well, if he says that,
if the Baroika fits or whatever,
Exactly. Where did that come from? The Russian spy thing, and that's my understanding is that what the feds have, and this is all a lot of it comes from the intelligence world, the NSA and CIA, is that Giuliani is very likely to have been a conduit for Russian propaganda and misinformation. I mean,
It's
where did
looked
the money
back,
that
and he was informed by the FBI in 2019 that he was being used this way. So it's not a casual comment on his part. It was the considered opinion of the FBI that wanted to warn him that, in fact, he was being so used. And it's part of the whole struggle, perennial struggle between Russia and Ukraine and Russia's sort of imperialistic ambitions in Ukraine, which he was supporting. He was supporting the puppet governments and not the the newly elected so-called free Ukraine constituents.
And of course, before him, Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, was not just supporting the puppet government that was overthrown. He was almost Yanukovych's right-hand man. So,
yeah.
And he was there through the time that Yanukovych's thugs were killing the young kids in the Maidan. So the question, though, arises, the money that Lev Parnas, these two hapless characters that showed up and got arrested at Dulles International, Parnas and Furman, Parnas paid Giuliani $500,000. And where did that money come from? And what's Parnas's business, if in quotes?
Right. Well, so in general, he's absolutely, Parnas and Furman are there. Henchmen on the ground. It is almost like a piece of modern theater or whatever. There's like with all this stuff, there are, if you blink, kind of comic aspects. So in everything, he's intimately related. In the particular episode involving the $500,000, we know it's characterized as a loan that he was able to secure to pay Giuliani, who, by the way, one of the least pieces of circumstantial evidence is just what a mercenary guy he was. Remember when he was going to represent Trump, he demanded $20,000 a day. The notion that all this work there he was doing out of the goodness of his heart or just to advise Trump is far-fetched for that reason. But for what this charge that is being investigated and quite seriously by the Department of Justice is that Giuliani was a lobbyist and failed to register. Now, you put it in those terms, it sounds kind of technical and regulatory, but it isn't. It's this really deeply important question of, is there somebody in the country who has the ear of the president who's really doing a foreign government's bidding? And if so, we got to at least know. We have to have the form that says, oh, wait a second, you're getting $500,000 from this foreign entity? Well, you would think Trump himself would say, I need to know that, and I could take your advice with a grain of salt. So this $500,000, it's, I believe, remains of obscure origin, and that matters because we want to be able to show most cleanly that either the Russians themselves or the out-of-party agitators, the out-of-power, agitators in Ukraine were hiring him to do their bidding with the president and Congress. So that's, I think, one of the things that are being really completely run down. But I want to make the point, and, you know, Adam Schiff's been making it well all week, that it's a sober and important overall interest that this law serves. And and Giuliani has had a sort of two-pronged rhetorical strategy. One is it's all politics, and the other is it's all, you know, ticky-tack, and neither of those is really supportable on the facts.
So we know that FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, is not exactly the strongest legal tool. At least it hasn't shown to be that way for some time. But you're saying that this is much more like super FARA, because FARA is not just being used by some corporation making a deal with somebody in the Middle East to sell arms and kicking money under the table. This is FARA with the President of the United States being used as the bait.
Exactly. This is, I know the President, give me money, And now I'll go talk to Donald and put, and we know for certain, I mean, the first impeachment showed that it dovetailed exactly with what Trump was trying to execute, fire the very solid career professional, support the corrupt former prosecutor, and really do ultimately Russia's bidding. Now, look, if he, it's bad enough, or it's certainly a subject for political response, if he is serving the interests of our gravest adversary in that area. But if somehow the reason it's happened is because there's an Iago-like figure who has, you know, gotten him all worked up about this because he's getting money on the side, that truly is a scandal. You're right, by the way, about FARA, not because it's a minor law, but it has been used rarely because they look for these most serious of charges. And it was the same kind of gravity that led them to do it in the case of Mike Flynn, right, who's arguably carrying on a rogue foreign policy. I just want to say it sounds like, you know, one more Washington bureaucrat alphabet soup. But this is, you know, take a step back. Think that there's a guy who is doing the bidding of basically our biggest adversary, and he's got the direct, couldn't have more direct, ear of the president. This is the guy, the president, when he calls up the Ukrainian president on July 25th call that gets him impeached, says, I'm going to have this great guy, Rudy Giuliani, come talk to you. Giuliani's not even in the government. He's running the show. If he's doing it for money, that's a really important thing for the American public to know.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litman, who's a former United States attorney and deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He's executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is Rudy Giuliani's Outrage is the Refuge of a Scoundrel. So the relationship between Trump and Giuliani has been a long one, but one of the things that I find curious, and I don't know that there's been a lot of investigative journalism targeted at this, is that we know that Giuliani was very tight with the New York field office of the FBI, and they were the ones that got hold of Anthony Weiner's laptop. And my understanding is that they were threatening to leak that information, even though it turned out that at the end of the day there wasn't much on that laptop. But it did force James Comey to have that incredibly disastrous press conference just before the election that Hillary Clinton claims cost her the presidency. Is it possible that Giuliani was in collusion with Trump on that, that Trump actually knew about what was happening there, if it's true, which I believe it is, that Giuliani was orchestrating that through the New York field office of the FBI?
Well, so first, a great question, by the way. And you're right that there hasn't been a whole lot of investigative reporting, but there is certainly a lot of anecdotal and even circumstantial evidence that A, the FBI in New York leaks like a sieve, and B, the faucet goes, one of it at least, directly to Giuliani. Remember when he said during the campaign, oh, there's going to be some problems coming out, he would go on TV and make these kinds of brash predictions. And that is because he had almost certainly, actually, let me take a step back. I'm talking as a pundit now. So as a lawyer, I would say there's strong evidence that that's because of his cozy relationship with FBI New York, which, by the way, is notoriously anti-Hillary, was at the time. One of the ironies of the whole outrage at the limited pockets of anti-Trump feeling, remember Page and Strzok, is that if you got a full printout of all the emails and texts from FBI agents who that were political in one sense, you would be, the anti-Hillary ones would swamp them in both virulence and number. So I think it's he probably was getting information. Did he tell it directly to Trump and coordinate? You know, it stands to reason. During that time, what an odd, strange relationship it has been, and what an odd, strange fall for the former America's mayor. But was he cozying up so much at the time? to Trump. I don't exactly recall. And he's a guy who's been in it for himself and has been looking for his own angles. But that he was involved and in the know, I think, fruitful investigative reporting would definitely bear out. And it certainly seems plausible that at a time, we're very late in the campaign, remember, that Trump is going to be the president, if any Republican will be, that he is trying to be sycophantic in that way certainly seems, a part of the way he plays the game.
Sure. And Trump apparently believed that he was going to lose the election. Then the Comey press conference shortly
turned
it around.
But it's such
totally.
An imponderable that people who were for Hillary will chafe at forever. It really did feel pivotal, and no one will ever know.
Sure. And, of course, in terms of Hillary, it gets her off the hook for the appalling campaign she ran. But let's focus in on the two times that the SDNY, Southern District of New York, tried to execute this warrant on Giuliani. It was during the Trump administration, and Barr looks like he shut it down. And he had an excuse because it was just before the election, 60 days prior.
Yeah,
but second time was after the election. And the irony that you point out in your article in the Los Angeles Times is that had they not turned that down for a second time, that would have enabled Giuliani to get his pardon, right? I mean, he tried to get a pardon from Trump, and Trump turned him down. And do we know why?
Well, Trump was juggling different things, but he wanted this sort of get out of jail free card that a few others wanted as well. And among other things, there's the law. There is no legal precedent for it, and presumably some people who were actually trying to give him legal advice, possibly Pat Cipollone at the end, who said you can't do that. But yeah, I think it does stand to reason if the feds have him in his sights, that would be the one the kind of pardon that would delight Trump to have given out. But of course, the big point is that it gives the lie to the second main Giuliani argument, which is it's just political reprisal and payback. The career prosecutors in SDNY wanted to go in, both before the election and after. As you say, the first one strikes me as, okay, that could influence an election. I don't see how the second one could have, but it shows that the kinds of people who, by the way, Garland is wanting to elevate and empower in his administration, that he's very much, this is a strain that I'm not sure people have appreciated so much. I think he really wants to defer to what the career folks are doing. Those are the people that, in fact, Barr was really, as things got worse and worse within the department, was openly disparaging. So they've now been empowered in a way that it makes sense that they would serve this. Because if you think about it, if this had just been brought to Garland as a new investigation, homegrown, starting, end of January, he might have said, do we really need this, fellas? But if it's brought to him by people who we've wanted to do this for months, it's nothing political because we've developed it. That's the sort of thing that he'd be likely to say, all right, you guys are the heart, soul of the department. The career professionals want to go forward. All right, go for it.
So, Harry, just in the last few minutes, let's turn to what's happening with this case of Crewe versus the DOJ.
Okay.
And it's prompted Judge Amy Bermy Jackson to basically demand that the DOJ release this memos that Barr made sure were kept secrets, and they will reveal what happened with the advice that Barr was getting from the DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel in terms of how he spun the Mueller report. And just to give you a sense of Judge Amy Bermy Jackson's skepticism about Barr, she's saying that Barr hardly had time to skim, much less study, the Mueller's reports, which were hundreds of pages of investigative work, before summarizing it for the Congress. So where do you think this is heading? This could actually end up being about misconduct, and it could be referred to bar associations. It could end up disbarring Barr. Obviously, you can't fire him because he's no longer there. How do you see this thing working out?
Right. Three quick points, Ian. First, when Berman Jackson says disingenuous, that's judge speak for you lying sack. She's read the memo, and the announcement and characterization that Barr gave after that, those first couple days, she thinks is absolute garbage. That's one. Two, maybe most importantly, people have to understand that even the new Merrick Garland Justice Department will be generally protective of DOJ priorities. DOJ is saying this is a deliberative process, and you therefore it's an exception to FOIA, which is the law that Crewe brought it under. And Berman Jackson is saying, no, it isn't, because he'd already made the decision. That's the cut. We should not be surprised if the department challenges her decision on appeal, and if they win, because that's just what they do, even though it's conservative in the Trump versus Biden kind of way of thinking. It's consistent with their protection. And finally, on the punishment point, you know, if this is aired and he's held up by history, as he in many ways he already is, to have been really dissembling, that's the biggest punishment. The different OPRs and IGs, et cetera, really can't lay a glove on him. And you know, as the 72-year-old eminence that he is, will not, that would exact no pain. So it's just really a matter of being right with history.
Well, at the end there, it seems like he was starting to think about getting right with history, Barr, because he did go public and say the election was a clean one, which plays against the Stop the Steal.
Somebody has to write this. There's a lot of things, most particularly the whole thing that the impeachment was for was an investigation of Hunter Biden. The DOJ was doing it, and he never told Trump. There's a more complicated, nuanced story about Bill Barr to be written.
Right. But you're saying, though, that the DOJ is not likely to release this memo.
I think they're likely to fight. Likely. Right. Even notwithstanding the big political context and their overall desire, they know as a matter of good government this should come out. But they have to think about their own institutional prerogative, and the next time somebody challenges the deliberative process exception, which their interest is in keeping robust.
Right, but just in closing, will the public ever see this memo, which looks like it's a real smoking gun?
One way or another, one time or another, the public will see this memo.
Well, Harry Lipman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you as always.
Thank you, and likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Lipman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department. He's now a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast, and a legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is Rudy Giuliani's Outrage is the Refuge of a Scoundrel. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the genocide underway in Tigray in Ethiopia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dennis Wadley, who's the director of Bridges of Hope International, which is a community development organization working mostly in Africa. And Dennis, you have been working in Ethiopia in the Tigray province. You were there, I believe, about a month ago when you were able to videotape the head of the Orthodox Church, who's under house arrest, and get him to make a statement, which is now mercifully being broadcast around the world. And this statement reveals the hideous truth that's been going on in this war-torn country now for months, which is that the Ethiopian army, along with the army of Eritrea, are conducting genocide in Tigray province. Is that an accurate summary?
Yes, and we've been working there for the last 11 years, doing leadership training and community development, and working closely with the Orthodox Church. And the messages that we had heard coming out of the genocide, as heinous as they were, when we arrived there a few weeks ago, it is worse than what we had been told. And the G7, having said that they were going to demand that the military leave, it did not happen. The military are fully in charge of the Tigray province. We have pictures of huge trucks full of military, large guns, the whole nine yards, in the town of Mekelle, which is where they originally were supposed to leave from. And while we were there, the military gunned down 12 innocent civilians standing at a bus stop and killed them all. So it is still very much occupied. The genocide is continuing. The stories are just absolutely heinous that the people that we met, the IDPs and the refugee centers, were telling.
Well, indeed, I was just looking at video from a spokesperson for UNICEF working in Tigray. It was just heartbreaking what he was saying about these young kids being shot, their parents being shot, and young girls as young as 14 being raped by the military. Apparently, rape is being used as a weapon, is it
It
not?
is. It is. It is. It is being used as a tool of war, and it's gang rape, and it's sometimes over a period of 2 weeks. And I heard about one hospital that had 200 rape victims, and 160 of them had been impregnated.
So, this has been going on for a long time. The tragic irony here is that Abiy, the leader of Ethiopia, recently received a Nobel Prize for Peace, and he had, he's basically been supported by the international community, and it's taken an awful long time for the international community to wake up to what's really happening. On the Security Council at the United Nations, any efforts to get teams in there and observers in there has been blocked by China and Russia. So, what are the geopolitics here? Why are the Chinese and Russians blocking efforts, and why have the Western countries been somewhat indifferent up until very recently?
I am not the one to comment on the political side of things. I really honestly am as stunned as you are at the lack of response. What I keep sharing with people and is that this is our generation's Rwanda, and one of the great regrets of the world community was that they waited for a couple of months before stepping in and making it end. And we've passed the 6 month mark. And whatever the political rationale, it doesn't matter. What matters is that literally homes are being burned down, crops are being destroyed. The projected long game of this is to starve to death 7 million people. And it has to end. And the world has got to rally. And the Pope needs to step up to the plate, and the Bishop of Canterbury needs to step up to the plate. The religious leaders around the world have to hear the cry of Abuna Mathias. The world has got to respond. The world leaders have got to respond and make this end.
And just follow up on the cry from the head of the Orthodox Church that you recorded. Tell us about him and his condition.
I count him a dear friend, and I've known him for the last 8 years, not for any other reason other than my wife and I serve the Orthodox Church and help them to help communities, help empower communities. But because of that, I've had many opportunities to sit and talk with him, and he's a very gentle soul. And when he has attempted, he tried 3 times to put out public statements to with the media. Insiders leaked the information and the government shut it down. Prior to now, what he said is he was on unofficial house arrest and could not travel. He said whenever he had a speaking engagement, there were people there that were watching, and they had threatened him and his life, which he didn't care about. But they also threatened the bishops and the people around him, who he feels deeply responsible for. And you know, when we began talking about what's happening throughout Tigray, he began to tear up and just said, you know, he loves the people of Tigray. He loves all Ethiopians, and that this has to end, and that he wanted to make a statement. And that's when I told him, you know, if you want to make a statement, I'm willing to record it. And he said, you would do that, you know, at risk to yourself? And I said, no, I'll do this because it's what you desire and you are my friend. And he literally paused for about 10 seconds and he said, I'm ready. And I hit record. And what you hear on that tape is directly from his heart. There were no notes. There was no preparation. There was no editing. It's him sharing his heart and his passion for the people of Tigray.
And that tape has been widely disseminated, and it is getting a response. But has he been punished by the government?
From what we can tell, they stormed the compound, and he is now under house arrest. And they've said that he is not allowed to have any visitors. Again, I hope, you know, he oversees 80 million people, 80 million Ethiopian Orthodox, a global community. And, you know, he has spoken the truth. And it's time now for the world leaders to stand up and to make this end. You know, the Eritrean army that was invited by the prime minister to come in, came in and slaughtered innocent civilians. My wife sat and wrote stories of children, you know, one little 13-year-old girl who, when the military came in, she ran with her uncle. Her parents ran a different direction. As she's running with her uncle, they shot and killed him, and she kept running and got herself to a town that then became so overrun with the refugees, IDPs, that she kept going on her own for 3 weeks and found her way to Mekelle. And now she's all alone. She doesn't know if anyone else in her family is alive. You know, another little girl that we met there, when they're fleeing, this little, sweet little girl was shot in the knee, and they had to just keep running. And the family feared she would bleed to death, and thank God she didn't. But these children are traumatized at what they've seen, and the family members they watch to be murdered. It's just been heinous.
And again, I'm speaking with Dennis Wadley, who is the director of Bridges of Hope International, which is a community development organization working mostly in Africa. So back to the indifference now. You mentioned that the G7 at least did discuss it, and Secretary of State Blinken is now aware of what's happening. I've tried to follow it. By the way, I interviewed earlier an Ethiopian scholar here in the United States, and he gave the government line and blamed everything on the Tigrayans for starting this civil war, which seems to be the way that the government is spinning it. And again, it is ironic that this leader, by the way, the Prime Minister, Abiy, who got the Nobel Prize, he's saying that he's finding the war tiresome now. Tiresome. I mean, a genocide's going on, and he thinks it's tiresome. I mean, what the hell is happening here?
Yeah. He wants the people of Tigray dead. They are powerful. They are a powerful region of the nation. They are also a peace-loving people. And I know, I am not going to comment on any of the politics. It's all beyond me. I don't know all the history. What I keep telling, you know, when Ethiopians play the party line of Abiy, what I tell them is, if this was happening in your province, if this was happening in the Amhara province, I would be fighting for you, because this genocide should not happen anywhere to any people, any place on the earth. And wherever it would happen, I will be your ally. And that's, you know, that's why, again, to me, yes, no doubt there have been problems in the past. No doubt there have been political issues. Nothing justifies the slaughter and the burning down and the destruction of religious sites and homes and farms and children being traumatized for the rest of their lives.
So when you were saying earlier that the end game is to basically starve the Tigrayan people, and that is why the head of the Orthodox Church who you videotaped and got the message out, where he says genocide is happening in Tigray.
Yeah.
The end game is to destroy, because it's a fairly rich agricultural area. So they basically, by destroying everybody's farm, that's the idea, to starve the rest of the population to death. Those they haven't killed, they'll starve.
Yeah, you know, that again is that is one of the theories that is out there, and the reason why they, you know, burn the crops and then are trying to keep people from returning, you know, while they're, you know, you have to wonder 6 months later, why are they still occupying these areas? And the best theory that I've heard is that they don't want them to be able to plant the crops. And so, you know, right now people are starving, and there are articles coming out about 36% of children in the rural areas are now malnourished. And it is looking like a man-made famine is going to unfold if the world does not step in.
So what do you think will happen in that regard? I mentioned that at least it's on the Secretary of State's radar now, finally, and that the G7 that recently in London did discuss what's going on. Russia and China are blocking efforts at the UN for any collective response. So what kind of response do you think will happen and obviously should happen?
You know, I hope that they will do whatever sanctioning, that even the African Union will step up, that, again, the religious leaders will put on a global stand against what's happening. I just feel, you know, the voices and voices like yours, you know, you have a powerful voice, and those around you, that we all have to scream no more. We all have to stand up and do our part. And I think we can. I think the world community needs to be willing to stand against any injustice like this, any place that it's happening. And I don't understand why the world leaders have been so weak on this, because it's clear. And so my hope is, and Abune Mathias's desire was, that adding his voice would help awaken the world. And that is my hope. It's my prayer. It's the cry of my heart.
Well, you mentioned earlier, Dennis, that you see this rather like what happened in Rwanda, where the world didn't pay attention when it was unfolding, the genocide. And then later, of course, too late, millions died. They finally acted. And by the way, both Al Gore and Bill Clinton to this day say it's the worst tragedy on their watch, for which they feel guilty, obviously. And Susan Rice, of course, feels that way too. So you really believe that there's an analogy there, a comparison that's valid?
I can't think of any other analogy that would fit more closely. And I do believe the world will have huge regrets if this is allowed to go on another month. And, you know, the stories are real. And having just been there, and, you know, my wife went over to do a trauma healing workshop, empowering people. And, you know, the people who came to this, who are living in these camps, they were business leaders and they were teachers, many teachers. You know, these are professionals whose lives have been demolished, who are now living in camps. And so she trained them so that they could help one another deal with trauma, and they could train others to be able to help people deal with the trauma of war and what's happened and what they've experienced, and to deal with rape. And again, it's all what you've read is, I believe, the tip of the iceberg. I think when this gets unpacked, it is like Rwanda. It is going to be one of the most heinous things the world has observed in a very, very long time.
And Abiy, the Prime Minister who got the Nobel Prize, got the prize, I believe, for ending the war with Eritrea that went on for a long time. But now he's invited the Eritrean army in, along with his own army, to massacre the Tigrayans. Yeah. What are the chances of getting them to withdraw? What kind of pressure could be put upon Eritrea?
You know, the G7 demanded that they withdraw, and the word on the street in Tigray is that they just switched into Ethiopian military uniforms. Abai has actually been attempting to pass some sort of law or, you know, edict that allows them to occupy Tigray, the Eritrean military to occupy Tigray. And if that happens again, it will be to the slaughter of countless people.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today. It's a grim subject, but the fact that nobody's been paying attention for 6 months as this genocide has been underway is just unconscionable. And I thank you for joining us here today, Dennis Wadley.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for helping to get the word out. And anything I can do to help, I'm happy to.
Well, thank you, Dennis. And again, I've been speaking with Dennis Wadley, who's a director of Bridges of Hope International, which is a community development organization working mostly in Africa. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the backlash to Biden's proposal to suspend vaccine patents, which European leaders say is fourth on the list of priorities, and that the real problem is production. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Shyam Balganesh, who's a professor of law at Columbia University, who writes and teaches in the area of copyright law, intellectual property, and legal theory. And he's the co-author of sections of the leading copyright law treatise, NEMA on Copyright. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shyam Balganesh.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the EU have been having a summit meeting in Portugal at which the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, said the Anglo-Saxons must first stop their export bans. And he went on to say, today the Anglo-Saxons block many of these ingredients and vaccines. Today, 100% of the vaccines produced in the United States are for the American market. So already you've had similar comments from Angela Merkel, suggesting that it's the waiving of the copyrights, or I guess IP, intellectual property rights, on COVID vaccines, in fact, will probably end up helping China. So a lot of pushback coming from Europe. I obviously want to talk to you about what's happening in India, but let's start with what's going on at this EU summit. What's your reading on it, Shyam?
So my reading on it, I think very importantly, it's important to recognize where the USTR is as things stand right now. I think there's been a lot of sense of either celebrating it or getting a little too hysterical about where it's going to end up. The USTR at this stage has just committed to participating in text-based negotiations around the idea of waiving patent protection for COVID vaccines. Now, the final outcome of that and exactly how they define the waiver, the term for which it will apply, the way in which they define COVID-related is all up in the air, and it's going to be many, many months. I think if the objection is to the very idea of the United States being willing to consider text, I think it's a little bit premature because, as most people have pointed out, the patent waiver is just a first but very important step in ramping up vaccine production. I think there's got to be a lot of things that accompany it for it to even work as a meaningful first step, such as there's got to be know-how sharing, there's got to be additional investments in infrastructure, there's got to be additional technology transfer. A lot of these vaccines have very complicated technologies that just can't be reverse engineered. So the bottom line is, I think to the extent that there's an objection, it's hard for me to see why there would be an in-principle objection to the idea of the USTR being willing to negotiate around the text, because what happens in that text is up in the air. It could be inert. So, but it just signals one important thing, Ian, which I want to emphasize, how hard it's going to be to see something truly meaningful in terms of the patent waiver. I think the fact that what the United States is saying is it's going to use its convening power to get everyone together, it's going to be hard. I think this will be a test of American leadership on the intellectual property front, and its moral leadership on being the country that's trying to end the pandemic globally. So we'll have to wait and watch. But the main thing to note is nothing is clear about what exactly this patent waiver is. We know for sure, I think we can say, that the October 2 language that India and South Africa proposed is unlikely to even be the preliminary basis on which the countries start negotiating. So we have no idea where they begin in terms of the text. So it's way too premature for countries to come out in opposition, in my view.
Well, but what the president of France said was, among what I just mentioned earlier, he said waiving patents should be fourth on the list of priorities. If we want to work quickly today, there isn't one factory in the world that can produce doses for poor countries because of intellectual property. But the priority today is not intellectual property. It's not true. We would be lying to ourselves. It's production. So is that the issue? Production?
I think that's right. I mean, I think when we're talking about the patent waiver and any effect it's going to have, it's going to be a long-term effect. If we're looking at ramping up immediate production to, let's say, impact countries that are facing a surge right now, absolutely. It's vaccine production, it's supply chain enhancements, and it's know-how distribution. It is not the intellectual property as such, which is the principal impediment. It's one part of it for the medium and long term, but I think to the extent that it has to be part of a broader package, the French president is absolutely right.
So what's happening in India then? India is apparently the world's biggest producer of vaccines, but they've only managed to vaccinate a little over 2% of their population. And my understanding is that Indian manufacturers of vaccines already have licensing agreements with AstraZeneca, and I believe with Pfizer, and also with Sputnik, the Russian one. Now, my understanding is that both Sputnik and the Chinese vaccination are not particularly effective. We don't even know about the testing of Sputnik. It just looks like they just started to put it in people's arms before it was tested, and we don't know that it's particularly effective. And the Chinese version, from what we learned in the Seychelles, is not effective at all. So what's going on in India in terms of the fact that they've got these licensing agreements, but yet they haven't managed to vaccinate more than a little over 2% of their people?
You know, it's hard to tell fully what the real problem is. Here's what I'm hearing from multiple news reports and people in India. I think the issue with ramping up vaccination was, first and foremost, a supply issue. There's certainly part of that. I think the production of vaccines and getting it distributed to the different vaccination centers was just not up there and not at the speed at which they had initially anticipated. They were initially very optimistic about the speed at which they could go, but as it turned out, it did not keep up with what they needed to be at. So one was in terms of procurement, government procurement, the distribution sources, the way in which the contracts were, capacity for manufacturing was actually allocated. So for instance, there are reports coming out that the government didn't procure enough for domestic distribution before it started committing to global export, which a story we've heard about. And India did a very morally appropriate thing, obviously, by helping out different countries by exporting vaccines. But the argument, the counter argument has been made as well, they didn't focus on the domestic production and distribution. So that's one part of the story in terms of the vaccine vaccination numbers in India. I think there's a second part, though, which should not be forgotten, which is that things seem to be going very well in India. People were not of the view that the vaccination needed to be ramped up. And I'm starting to hear reports that there was a sense of complacency. Now, these are all secondhand reports that the rapidity of the vaccination started coming down, where people started saying, look, this thing is coming under control. Maybe we can delay it a little bit. The sense of urgency, right, which is absolutely critical, which we saw here in the United States, I think had somehow the acceleration on that had been pulled back. And I think that was an important contributor as well. So it's a combination of both the supply chain, the distribution, the procurement capacity. And even though there were those licenses, I think there wasn't this sense that the sense of urgency that was absolutely critical to fill the domestic demand. And that's the reason you have the mess that you have right now.
So back in October, when the governments of South Africa and India petitioned the World Trade Organization to issue a temporary waiver on the agreement, it's called the TRIPS Agreement on Intellectual Property, you were saying earlier that that's not likely to happen or it's not particularly workable. But what about the extent to which the American public have subsidized with its tax dollars the medical breakthrough of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine and the UK public have funded AstraZeneca's? In other words, what do the public get back in terms of this taxpayer subsidies?
Through the waiver? So I think the easy answer is this is a global pandemic. No one is safe until everyone is safe. So the pandemic doesn't end here in the United States until people around the world are no longer getting infected and generating new variants through infection. So I think the answer is that to the extent that these patent waivers, this is the analytics, to the extent that the patent waiver is ramping up vaccination around the world, this is not just a hypothetical benefit that is coming to the public in the United States or the UK where they funded through taxpayer dollars the research, but it's actually a very tangible benefit because this pandemic does not end. The economy does not return to a sense of real normality until the people around the world are not generating new variants. And I think India is the case in point. I think what we have to remember is what really sparked all of this, right? The push towards the patent waiver and the change in the United States' position happens when you see this surge in India. Right, when Biden is talking to Prime Minister Modi and there's a conversation about how this is important. So the recognition is that vaccinating the populations around the world, given the interconnected nature of economies, is something that the public here in the United States directly, not indirectly, directly benefits from because of the nature of the pandemic. I think that's a critical point, but I just want to go back to where you began, Ian, which is the October 2nd proposal of India and South Africa. I think it's important to recognize why that is unlikely to be the basis for, I think, the waiver that we see going forward. And it's something that I believe is missed in a lot of the conversations about the waiver. So when India and South Africa in October of 2020 were pushing for this waiver, it was a very expansive waiver. It's important to remember that they were pushing for that waiver well before the vaccines were rolled out or authorized, right? This is October. And the waiver was not just limited to patents. It applied beyond patents to other forms of intellectual property in the TRIPS agreement. And very, very importantly, it was not limited to vaccines, right? It extended to diagnostics, it extended to therapeutics, and the actual phrasing of it was so expansive, it said anything related to the prevention, containment, or treatment of COVID-19. What you're seeing right now, to the extent that the USTR statement is our first step, is a commitment to talking about a waiver for A, patents, and B, as they relate to COVID vaccines. What's forgotten in all of this is that there's still a very important need for COVID therapeutics, right? So to the extent that there's the remdesivirs of the world or other therapeutics that are going to be critical in the short term to ensuring against a surge or containing a surge, and very importantly, those could be easier to manufacture through reverse engineering. That's not, at least on as things stand right now from the USTR, part of the conversation. But they were in October. So that's part of the reason why I think that they're going to begin with completely new text, because the nature of this pandemic has transformed between October and right now, and the priorities of what countries are talking about has also. We have very good vaccines. I don't think we have therapeutics at the same level as the vaccines.
Well, it's obvious that Biden's got an ambitious agenda to vaccinate 70% of all adults in this country by July the 4th. But the problem is, as you've pointed out, is that if the rest of the world is not vaccinated, even more deadly strains are developing. There's already a pretty deadly strain in India. And frankly, what we're hearing in India is pretty bad, but it's mostly set in the cities. Now, when it spreads, which it obviously is spreading, to the country where over 60% of the people live in small villages, where they have less of a medical infrastructure, it's likely to get worse. So the longer we don't deal with the rest of the world, and particularly countries like South Africa and India, and stop it there, the more likely it is that an even more deadly strain is going to come back to the United States at some point in the future, and perhaps the effective vaccines of Moderna and Pfizer could be inadequate. You may have to either get a booster or they may have to reformulate them. So everybody's in this.
Exactly. And
so just what's your last bit of advice here for particularly the Europeans are meeting, as I mentioned, at the EU summit in Portugal? We don't want to get into a kind of squabble over this, but that seems to be what's shaping up.
Right. I think, unfortunately, that's what's shaping up around the rhetoric. I think a couple of pieces of advice, I think, one is to keep our eye on the ball and to see what happens in terms of next steps. Nothing has been predetermined. I think there's a clear commitment that this is one part of the puzzle. But it's important to emphasize, and I want to reiterate, it is a puzzle. Right, ramping up vaccine production requires a complex set of additional investments, an additional set of maneuvers, all of which need to happen in tandem and sequentially. Waiving patent protection is on its own not going to be enough, unequivocally. I think the question is whether the Biden administrations or the other countries that are committed to ensuring global vaccine supply chains increasing are able to bring these other mechanisms to the table or encourage private actors to get involved in them. That's when we're going to start seeing a ramp up. To the extent that I would say that we have a tussle going on or likely to be seen at the WTO, I think it's going to be around the extent to which this comes to be seen as short-term or long-term and the scope. So for anyone keeping a key eye on the patent waiver issue, I would say pay close attention to the text, because phrasing the terms of the waiver, the extent to which things are waived, and very, very importantly, and this is often forgotten, it's going to be a temporary waiver. How do we determine when it has what the temporary period is? Is it going to be a matter of years? Is it going to be based on when the pandemic ends? What is our defining target? Those are the kinds of things that I think are going to be next steps in terms of discussing the patent waiver. But I really want to emphasize one critical part here. This is not going to solve the problem of surges, right? I've been talking to a lot of friends and people in India who have asked me about the effect of this patent waiver and whether it's going to mean anything meaningfully different for what's going on in India right now or in the coming weeks. And my short answer is no, it is not, right? This signals American leadership as a willingness to participate in a multilateral conversation because of the recognition that it's an interconnected world, just as you pointed out. Even if the public has paid for it here, we are not safe until everyone is safe around the world. And that's a critical recognition, which we didn't see under the prior administration. We see it right now under Biden, and I think that's important. But it should not be forgotten that there isn't any effect that you're going to see from these patent waivers, if there is one in conjunction with these other requirements, is going to be long term. So stay tuned, keep your eye on the ball, and I think the key point here is let's not talk about the ripple effects of this from six layers down, because we have no idea what this waiver is. All we know right now is that we're willing to talk about it.
Well, Shyam Balganesh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Shyam Balganesh, who's a professor of law at Columbia University, who writes and teaches in the area of copyright law, intellectual property, and legal theory. And he's the co-author of sections of the leading copyright law treatise, NEMA on Copyright. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.